This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, with all the discussions of the revived GOP healthcare bill, it's gotten me to think about healthcare cost. The revised bill takes away many of the Affordable Care Act restrictions, but also many of the protections. I think it's fair to say that if the bill goes through the House as written, there'll be many Americans who can no longer afford health coverage.
And it will significantly shift the burden of paying for healthcare onto the consumer. And at the same time, it's going to cover a whole lot less.
It still leaves many unanswered questions for the health industry moving forward and what the potential impact of the loss of tax subsidies will mean, not only for the insurance market, but also the number of Americans who may end up uninsured. So not necessarily what we would call progress, Margaret.
And that's something that has been on the mind of today's guest for some time. Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal is the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News, and she's just published a really riveting book, An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back.
And as well, Laurie Robertson stops by, the managing editor of FactCheck.org. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter because we love to hear from you. Now, we'll get to our interview with Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Congress has come to agreement on a $1 trillion temporary spending bill, keeping government from shutting down, at least until the end of September. The spending package includes a number of measures, including more money for defense spending, but also more money for the National Institutes of Health than anyone expected under the president's budget proposals. And the House Republicans have tried yet again to muster enough votes to support the latest iteration of the GOP health care bill, something the president has been keen on seeing move forward after the failure of the American Health Care Act. While the slightly revised bill technically retains protections for people with pre-existing conditions, it still leaves that decision up to the states. And that's left some moderate Republicans on the fence about potentially putting their vulnerable constituents at greater risk. Health disparities have improved slightly since the year 2000 to 2015, but African Americans are still more likely to die earlier than whites in this country. A recent report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows the average life expectancy for Black Americans is 75.6 years and 79 years for whites. Study also found more African Americans dealing with or dying in their 30s and 40s from diseases typically found in older adults, such as heart disease and diabetes. Higher rates of obesity in that population being considered as one of the causes. Cleveland Clinic will be getting a new leader sometime this year, Dr. Toby Cosgrove, announcing he'll be stepping down after 10 years as CEO, with many patents and breakthrough innovations to his name. No successor has been named, but Cosgrove expects it'll be an internal promotion. He will be staying on as an advisor. And so much for the transformation of the American school lunch set in motion during the Obama administration and promoted heavily by First Lady Michelle Obama. Secretary of Agriculture under President Trump just signed a measure that rolls back certain dietary guidelines that reduced salt, fat, and sugar contents in the typical school lunch. Former Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue, now the Agriculture Secretary, signed the measure that delays sodium restriction in school lunches and leaves more room for discretion in local purchasing for school cafeterias. Michelle Obama had pushed the healthier food changes as part of her Let's Move campaign aimed at combating childhood obesity, which is expected to cost the American healthcare system hundreds of billions of dollars in coming decades. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and the author of a newly released book, An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Dr. Rosenthal was a well-known reporter for the New York Times, where she covered healthcare as well as the environment. She earned multiple awards for her two-year series on health pricing, Paying Till It Hurts. She's a graduate of Stanford University and Harvard Medical School. Elizabeth, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah. You know, first of all, congratulations. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful. The book, An American Sickness, is published by Penguin Random House, which at last check had risen to number 6 on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list. And I think Americans of all political stripes are really trying to understand what's driving the American healthcare to be the most expensive in the world. And maybe you could share with our listeners, using the emergency room as a metaphor and American healthcare as a patient, could you describe the diagnosis and what condition you think the patient's in?
The patient is approaching critical condition, I think. We're reaching a tipping point of unsustainability, both in terms of personal income, where I hear from more and more people who are spending 20 to 30% of their household income on health insurance and minor health care, not even, you know, a serious heart attack. We've all faced rising in premiums, deductibles, and I think what we're seeing at the town halls now is people standing up and saying, you know, wait, I just can't do this anymore. So I think we really have to face this central issue in American healthcare, which frankly we haven't faced head on ever, which is the prices and how they got to be at this crazy place where we're, you know, 2, 3, sometimes 100 times as much with certain procedures and medicines as they are in the rest of the world.
Well, Elizabeth, you started to focus on the nation's health cost crisis a few years ago with your New York Times series, Paying Till It Hurts, trying to determine what was driving the skyrocketing cost of healthcare to an almost $3.5 trillion a year industry. Take us to the beginning. What unique insights do you think you can bring to help us better understand the roots of the current crisis?
Everyone knows it's too expensive, and no one would have designed a system like this. So how did we get here? And that's really what was my personal odyssey in the first part of the book. The first step was the development of employer-sponsored health insurance in the post-World War II era. And that is not to say that health insurance is a bad thing. But what that set off was this kind of disconnect between a patient paying for health care and what was charged, because the insurers were paying. 10, 20 years ago, your employer provided you with insurance. There was little out-of-pocket cost to you. And so it was all kind of funny money. It was invisible. And what happened then is the business of healthcare starts insinuating into a system that was focused on caring and patients and this healing endeavor, which is where I started as a physician in medical school and residency. You know, we weren't paying it directly. It was kind of a white-collar crime. Nobody was paying. So if you were charging $50, you could charge $100, and then you would charge $500. And at some point along the way, business consultants started being involved. They went into hospitals. Consultants like Deloitte and McKinsey would go in and say, you know, you can make a lot more money doing the exact same things if you just billed this way. And that's where we started getting the $17 charges for Tylenol or the $200 for every 15 minutes of oxygen therapy. And of course, once the hospitals are making money, the doctors begin to sound almost kind of Marxist, like, you know, wait, we're the labor here. We want some of that too. Why are these guys all being paid $1 million plus a year when we're producing the value in this institution? And likewise, drugs, which were always kind of cheap, and devices, which were traditionally kind of like Band-Aids, you know, they were just the ancillary things, suddenly start charging a lot too. And pretty soon you have all this money kind of sloshing around. And a lot of people who are motivated by business and the values of business trying to grab for it. And what's lost, I think, in that is the values that physicians and patients hold dear.
Elizabeth, you don't pull any punches in your book. In it, you say that if we were trying to cure polio today, we'd still have polio, but we'd have iron lungs offered in 7 different colors. And it's hard to imagine a modern-day Jonas Salk who would be willing to offer his cure for polio to the world and forego any profits from the discovery. I wonder if you could talk about this aspect, the high cost of medical and pharmaceutical research and the outrageous prices of drugs today.
I think we really have to think about our closely held belief in this country that the profit motive is a good way to direct innovation and drug discovery in healthcare. It does incentivize certain kinds of things that the discoverer can charge a lot for. It does not incentivize cures that might lower costs or be really cheap. So, you know, there are a couple of examples in the book, one of which is a physician at Mass General who's been researching a cure for type 1 diabetes. Her work may not result in that cure, but it's kind of engendered a lot of excitement in the basic science community. But she can't get that funded by either pharma or the patient groups devoted to type 1 diabetes because, as she said, she went to a bunch of pharmaceutical companies and they said, wow, that's really interesting, but how are we going to make money from it? Treating diabetes is an industry worth billions in this country. Mm-hmm. And if there was a cure for type 1 diabetes, that whole industry would go away. So what's our model for that kind of discovery? And of course, in Salk's days, the idea that you could patent this thing that was developed with public research, it just wasn't a goal. But now, of course, every university would be fighting over the patent for that. You know, we look now at CRISPR technology, mm-hmm. you know, which is an important new technology, mm-hmm. potentially. What have the news articles been about? It's about whether the Broad Institute or the University of California holds the patent. When I wrote about healthcare reform, we always talked about, well, these innovations were going to lead to patient-centered, evidence-based mm-hmm. care. And then when I started to write the book, I was like, whoa, what other kind of care could there possibly be? And now we see in our country, it's finance-based care. Is there a profit in it for someone? It's business values, but those are not necessarily what any of us want from healthcare.
You point to another key driver behind the nation's healthcare sticker shock, and that's hospital costs. We know that many hospital rates are set really in secrecy, and you say that the other very menacing trend is the accelerating trend of hospital consolidation, which, of course, may do much to eliminate competition in many markets. Talk with us more about how does the average consumer get a handle on this without having a consultant after discharge to help them figure it out?
Right now, it's hard, but there's a lot that can be done. We need much greater transparency. You need to have a real price to shop for anything, whether it's our employers shopping on our behalf or us shopping individually in this era of higher copays and deductibles. And hospitals, as you said, go to great lengths to hide these list prices. Even doctors, particularly some of the younger doctors, I heard from one resident at a hospital in Arizona who was a radiology resident, and he wanted to know, like, how much are you guys charging for an MRI? And the business office wouldn't tell him. And I hear this even from more senior doctors who are increasingly concerned about costs. All hospitals have this thing called a charge master, which is mm-hmm. their master price list.
Right.
In almost all states, those are top secret and guarded as kind of trade secrets. In California, they have to be filed with the state. I'd like to see that in all states, and I don't see why it's not possible. And I think once those things are filed publicly, then advocates or physicians or just patients who are really motivated can look at them and say, whoa, you know, they're charging $1,000 for every 15 minutes I was in the recovery room. Mm-hmm. I was only there because the surgical team was having dinner that long. That doesn't make any sense. The other thing is, I think if hospitals had to file these costs and make them public, you know, my colonoscopy at a hospital in New York was billed at $11,000. I know that if they had to list that price mm-hmm. and put it in the lobby, they would have never charged that. So I think the first step is greater transparency. And you often hear a million different excuses why hospitals and physicians can't do that. You know, hospitals will say, well, nobody pays those prices. And if you ask, well, why do you charge them then? Literally, one hospital exec said to me, well, because sometimes a foreigner with a big suitcase of cash comes in and does pay it. Another thing you hear is nobody really pays it. Well, the uninsured, often hospitals do go after them for those big bills. There's a woman in the book who was billed over $350,000 for surgery after a cerebral aneurysm. The hospital would have accepted under $100,000 from Medicare, from the VA, but because she didn't have anyone negotiating on her behalf, they went after her for 80% of the whole thing. It was a nightmare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and author of the newly released An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Elizabeth, as we know, the president ran on the platform of repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act. And you say in your book that no reform of the Affordable Care Act addresses the unsustainable cost of getting sick. What needs to happen politically to lead to better containment of health costs?
You know, the original proposal by the Obama administration did try and deal with this pricing issue head on. A lot of the truly price-reducing and cost-saving components were knocked out. But look, who was at the table? It was the insurers, the hospital associations, the medical trade associations, pharma. But who's representing the patients? And that's partly what I want the book to do, to develop patients as a constituency that votes on this health care issue, saying, hey, wait a second, we want more of a say in how our health care works. There are various steps that I think people can and should take. You know, to look at these explanation of benefits statements, literally there's one person in the book who, he and his wife had a baby, and they were billed for a circumcision. They knew their baby wasn't circumcised. So they went back and argued with the hospital. I think we have to start holding these institutions accountable. They also don't pay taxes because they're doing service for our community. Okay, well, let's look at their 990 tax forms and say, what have you done for my city to deserve that big tax break? And likewise, you know, when you're going to your doctor's office and say, I care about these costs, will you work with me on it? Doctor, please learn which of the x-ray facilities in this area will do it for $50 rather than $1,000. We need to learn how much money did pharma contribute to my representative's campaign last year? Who's my state insurance commissioners? Right now, most of those insurance commissioners are drawn from the insurance industry. As patients, we should say no. Those commissioners should be consumer advocates. You know, it's sad that we in this country have to deal with these issues while we're dealing with a medical crisis. You know, when you go to an emergency room, do you really want to have to say, okay, I've come to this in-network hospital, but doctor, are you in my network? But I think right now we have to ask those questions with the ultimate goal being, if I go into an in-network hospital, hospital, it's your job to make sure that everyone who touches me is in my network. You know, when I was an ER doctor, it was just assumed that the ER doctor was part of the bill. It wasn't even separate billing. But now a lot of hospitals have wanted these ER doctors to be contractors, and the more entrepreneurial ones have seen it as a good money-making opportunity. The problem with their arguments is you and me, the patients, we're stuck in the middle,
we
have no hand to play in this negotiation.
So, Elizabeth, it is hard not to come around to the idea of a single-payer system when you have this conversation about price, to look at our Medicare colleagues and the degree to which they're able to control that administrative limit and still do quite a bit of innovation, as we've seen over recent years. We saw the state of Vermont try, almost got there with single-payer, couldn't do it. Talk to me about whether you think that would be a solution to the problem and whether it's remotely possible in this country.
Of course it would be a solution. I mean, it's worked in many other countries. I think every country has developed a system that meets their kind of cultural preferences, their political reality, and their medical practices. And many of them have gone to single payer. When people say, oh, that would never work in the U.S., well, Medicare is a single-payer system, and while it has its issues, I hear from a lot of readers in their 50s and 60s who are all looking forward to, you know, the promised land of Medicare. And likewise, I hear from more and more physicians who are now saying, fine, let's just go with Medicare. You know, it doesn't pay as well as some of the other payers, but it's fine. I can live with it, and it's much less hassle.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and author of the newly released An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. You can learn more about her work by going to americansickness.com, or you can follow her on Twitter at Rosenthal Health. Elizabeth, thank you for your work and for your book and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thanks so much for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
President Trump recently hit the 100-day milestone of his presidency, and we looked back at the false and misleading claims he has made in that time. On healthcare, Trump's falsehoods were about Obamacare. He said that, quote, Obamacare is dead, repeating a common talking point that the Affordable Care Act is in a death spiral, with rising premiums forcing relatively healthy people to drop coverage, leading to even higher premiums to cover an ever sicker group of beneficiaries. We found the ACA marketplaces are ailing in some states, such as Tennessee, but flourishing in others, including New York and California. And while some insurers have lost money and are leaving, others see opportunity and are getting in. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office and other neutral experts say the ACA marketplaces are probably stable for years to come. Trump has mentioned Tennessee several times, claiming that half the state doesn't have an insurance company selling policies on the ACA exchanges and that, quote, the other half is going to lose the insurance company. Not true. All of Tennessee's 8 insurance rating areas have at least one carrier offering Affordable Care Act policies in 2017. For next year, Humana has announced it will cease offering ACA policies. That would leave 79,000 Tennessee residents in the Knoxville area without ACA coverage. A spokesman for the state's Department of Commerce and Insurance said the state is hopeful an insurance carrier will offer coverage in that area next year. In his first 100 days, Trump also said that, quote, many of our best and brightest are leaving the medical profession entirely because of Obamacare. Actually, the total number of active physicians has increased nearly 8% under the health care law, according to the Association of American Medical Colleges. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Each year, more than 1 million babies die at birth, and another 3 million die within the first few weeks of life, often from preventable causes. And when babies are born prematurely, the risks escalate. Newborns, and particularly preemies, have a considerable amount of difficulty regulating their own body temperature, and without access to incubators, babies in the third world often succumb to hypothermia. That got former Stanford MBA student Jane Chen thinking, how do we develop a low-cost solution to the problem?
My team and I realized what was needed was a local solution, something that could work without electricity, that was simple enough for a mother or a midwife to use. We needed something that was portable, something that could be sterilized and reused across multiple babies, and something ultra-low-cost.
Speaking at a recent TED Talk, Chen said that they developed a cocoon-like device called, simply, Embrace, a thermal body wrap that encases the baby and helps regulate body temperature for up to 6 hours.
Looks like a small sleeping bag for a baby. It's waterproof. There's no seams inside, so you can sterilize it very easily. But the magic is in this pouch of wax. It's a wax-like substance with a melting point of human body temperature. You can melt this simply using hot water, and then it's able to maintain one constant temperature for 4 to 6 hours at a time. And it creates a warm microenvironment for the baby.
Chen and her developers have managed to keep the cost of the Embrace baby warmer at around $25 per unit. Since launching the product, they estimate that over 150,000 babies' lives may have been saved with the device, a low-cost, high-tech, portable temperature regulator designed to regulate preemies' body temperatures to ensure that they not only survive premature birth, but ultimately thrive as well. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.